Okay, we have a quorum, so I call the meeting to order. First thing we need to do here is to approve the minutes from January 29th. Would someone like to move the minutes? Did you not? January 29th? Okay, Representative Gardner moves approval of the minutes for January 29th. So, all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Minutes are approved. Today we're going to be discussing and hearing testimony on House File 250, which is Representative Knuth's bill dealing with toxins in children and child products. And we're not going to be taking action today. We will not have the bill before us. The bill is actually still sitting in Health Committee. It was heard today in Health Policy, and no action was taken today. They're going to be taking it up tomorrow. And if action is taken soon enough, we'll be taking it up on Thursday for action. But at this point, we're just going to be hearing testimony today. And for those, for the committee members, if you would put your papers back in the saved section, because this bill will be coming back up again on Thursday, I would recommend that you do that. And with that, we're going to start first with Representative Knuth. If you'd like to present the bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and committee members. I'm going to just introduce the bill quickly and kind of the framework, and then we're going to have a testifier who has to leave town quickly, so I'm hopefully a few minutes won't make you late for your plane. First of all, thank you for hearing the bill, and the reason I'm bringing this bill forward is to make sure Minnesotans have adequate information, and also we're taking adequate regulation steps to protect our public health, both of the general public, but particularly our children, by making sure we're not having toxic chemicals and products in our environment. And I do want to stress it's both the adequate information and regulation. Those are key aspects of this bill. And the framework for this is looking at how our chemicals are assessed and regulated both state and federally. And just last week, the Government Accountability Office came out with their high-risk list, which is a list they put out every 2 years, and how the lack of information and regulations at the EPA in the federal level, that was added to their high-risk list. They don't have the controls to limit public exposure to many chemicals that may pose substantial health risks, and there should be some information about this in your packet. I'm going to leave a lot of the information about health and the effects of toxic chemicals to Dr. Meyer, who will be testifying later. He's our national expert, also another reason we're having this hearing today. But I'm going to just run through the bill real quickly. And first, we want to classify, we have 60 or 80,000 chemicals out on the market. We want to classify chemicals of high concern. Chemicals of high concern are endocrine and hormone disruption, developmental toxins, toxins that can cause cancer, persistent bioaccumulative and toxic chemicals. And so that narrows that list down significantly. Maine and Washington are actually taking steps to create these sorts of lists as well. And then from within that list, we want to identify priority chemicals. These are chemicals that are found around humans, in human fluids or tissues, in our indoor environments, in dust, indoor air, drinking water, in our homes. Also high production chemicals, so chemicals that are produced in significant levels in this country, and then also chemicals that are banned in another state, so that they could go on our high priority list. So that's another way we're breaking down what chemicals we're taking action on, because there are so many chemicals. And once a priority chemical is identified, we need a report back to the agency and also notify distributors. And let me step back on this point. We're not looking for retailers. We're not trying to regulate retailers. We want to look at the people manufacturing products with these chemicals in it and make sure that they're reporting back to the agency and also reporting to their distributors. And then when we have those report backs, we want to take steps to find safer alternatives, chemicals that are not of high concern, that have similar or the same functionality. If a chemical is banned in another state, we would presume there is a safer alternative that state is using for the same chemical. then if it's an apparel novelty item, we could find a safer alternative in that case. So we're not instantly banning a lot of chemicals. There's a lot of steps on the way. We're better informing our public and taking steps to assess the chemicals in our environment. There's some exceptions and exemptions to this regulation, which you can look at in the bill. We can answer questions about that if you like. And then also have the state participate in the Interstate Chemical Clearinghouse, which is developed by the University of Massachusetts Lowell, a way to share information about these chemicals, and then asking for two reports back. One is how we will implement and fund the priority chemical part of this legislation, which will take effect in a couple years, and how we do that effectively, and then also a report on how we evaluate and regulate toxic chemicals in all consumer products. This bill, rightly so, focuses on children. As you'll hear, children are the most susceptible to low doses and tiny doses of certain chemicals, and they can have significant effects on development and later in life. But we want to be looking at some options and ideas from our state agencies on furthering this and making sure we're doing it as effectively as we can. So with that, I think we're going to have our first testifier.
Thank you, Representative Smith. And yeah, we do have one person we're moving up on the list, Ms. Kathleen Roberts from the American Chemistry Council. No, she has to leave early, and she will be testifying in opposition to the bill. So if you could please state your name for the record, please.
My name is Kathleen Roberts. I'm with the American Chemistry Council. I'd like to thank the chair and the committee members for adjusting the schedule to accommodate my trip home. The American Chemistry Council represents the leading companies engaged in the business of chemistry. ACC members apply the science of chemistry to make innovative products and services that make people's lives better, healthier, and safer. We're pleased to be here to offer comments on House File 250. Generally speaking, we have a number of pragmatic concerns on the process that's laid out in the legislation, and we would encourage Minnesota to consider those issues as we raise them. ACC and its members are committed to improving environmental health and safety performance, particularly when it comes to fundamental issues like children's health. Through our industry's Responsible Care, which is a voluntary program that all of our members are committed to, common sense advocacy, and health and environmental research that's done under our ACC umbrella, our members are committed to enhancing and improving the protection of health and environment through chemistry. ACC is interested in this bill because, like the drafter, we're certainly supportive of the objective of protecting children from harmful exposures to chemicals. ACC and its members encourage the development of toxicity exposure and health-related information about its products, especially where children are concerned. We've participated in the High Production Volume Challenge, which is a program where our members voluntarily collect or develop data on the approximately 3,000 chemicals that represent 95% of the volume of chemicals in the U.S. And we made that information publicly available through a website on EPA. It's called the HPV Information System. We've also worked with EPA on the Voluntary Children's Chemical Evaluation Program, a program to understand how exposures to children can best be assessed. Children don't act like adults. Well, like most adults anyway. They are on the floor. They put things in their mouths. So their exposure to different products are very different than adults, and there needs to be a different system to assess that exposure. We've long supported the National Children's Health Study. It's a long-term study of all of the environmental factors influence children's health in the U.S., and that includes diet, economic status, and possible chemical exposures. We've worked in Minnesota and elsewhere to better understand biomonitoring data, information about chemicals that are found in our body, what does it mean, what are the implications. We've long advocated for more research to be done to, again, better understand the appropriate interpretation of that data. We believe that legislation that improves transparency and information about chemicals used in products, children's products or any product, is a good move. Such an approach can help parents, chemical users, and the government have the appropriate information at hand to address their concerns. ACC believes that the legislation focusing on identifying and assessing priority chemicals as potential concerns is appropriate. Again, though, we do have some concerns about the process as it's laid out, and I'd like to identify those now. In particular, we would strongly encourage Minnesota to prioritize not only the chemicals, but the products that you're going to be looking at as you go through this process. Resources are limited everywhere. They're limited within the government. They're limited within the company. So it's best to apply those resources to those products and chemicals that are of highest concern. We believe that the legislation really needs to focus on both hazard and exposure information. Hazard is only one part of the equation. Hazard and exposure together determine whether a chemical poses any risk from its use in a product. Indeed, in addition to determining whether a chemical is in a children's product, so in addition to determining whether a priority chemical that's on one of those lists, whether that's in the product, you also need to determine whether that chemical is going to escape from that product, thereby causing a potential exposure to the child. The mere presence of a chemical in and of itself does not indicate potential concern for health or environmental impact. The legislation should address the concept of thresholds for presence of a priority chemical in a children's product. Right now, as we see it, there is no separate step identified for that purpose. The bill defines as high priority chemicals any substance found to be present in environmental media or the human body. We think the legislation should be made clearer that the Pollution Control Agency, PCA, has a responsibility to screen those lists of chemicals against chemicals that are found in children's products to make sure that you're chasing after the right chemicals, so to speak. We have a concern with using the HPV, high production volume chemicals, as a surrogate for high priority chemicals. Chemical regulatory systems around the world recognize that volume, which is what the HPV is, it's only a measure of the amount that is imported or produced at a certain time. Volume is a very poor surrogate for exposure, and in this instance, it's an even poorer surrogate for possible children's exposure. In addition to the listing of priority chemicals, we also have some concerns with the required alternative assessment process. The legislation defines an alternative as a substitute process, product, material, chemical, strategy, or combination of those that serves as a functionally equivalent corpus. Something that is functionally equivalent that does not necessarily have other key product development issues such as quality or feasibility or risks or cost. So, for example, you might have a monomer, a residual monomer that's used to make a polymer, that's used to make a plastic, that's used in a child's car seat. So there might be some concern about that residual monomer. So you've reconfigured the plastic now to get rid of that monomer, but is that plastic as durable? Will it withstand the impact of a car crash better than the original? Have we substituted one problem for another? So as Minnesota considers further hopeful amendments to this or changes to this, we would encourage that any assessment that's done on the priority chemical, that same robust assessment should be done on the alternative to make sure that you're not, again, substituting one problem for another. Under this legislation's mandate, the safer alternatives to be used in children's manufacturing products would be determined by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I don't know if someone from MPCA is going to be speaking here today, but alternative assessment process is a complicated, intense, relatively new process that's out there, and so I think the question would be, does the Minnesota PCA have the resources and expertise and the finances needed in order to do those assessments? More importantly, science does not seem to drive the decisions on alternatives. The mere availability of an alternative seems to be able to trigger a decision to require that alternative without regard to the actual risk to the alternative. So the fact that an alternative is being used in another state, is it being used for the same purpose? Will it provide the same quality and performance? And again, has it had the same level of risk assessment done for that? Finally, the bill requires the manufacturer of a children's product to report the amount of the priority chemical in each unit of the product to the state. This seems to be a burdensome requirement, as it implies a requirement to test for the presence of all priority chemicals without regard to a threshold and without regard whether there's a risk to exposure. In addition, the requirement appears to have no bearing on the rest of the legislation, since the mere presence of a priority chemical is sufficient to trigger the requirement to go through. So in other words, why are you asking people to measure the amount of the priority chemical in there if in fact the fact that the priority chemical is there at all is going to require them to make a change in their product? We would strongly encourage the sponsors to consider amending the bill to focus not just on the hazards, but on the actual exposure risks in the children's products as well. Protecting kids is an important, essential element for state governments, for the federal governments, and obviously for any parents like myself that are out there. What you have in front of you is a complicated, evolving, and quite frankly, Herculean task to look at the priority chemicals and then to look at the different products that those chemicals are in, the functions of those chemicals in those products, and make sure that changes can be made in a safe and alternative way. We would encourage Minnesota to be practical and pragmatic in approaching this, again, in order to make sure that resources are focused on the right areas. Thank you very much for your time.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Roberts. And I'll open it up to any questions that members may have. Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we just heard this bill. And so I did have a question on this pharmaceuticals issue. I've heard there's an exemption for pharmaceuticals, and I'm not seeing it in the language. I don't know if this is for Ms. Roberts or for Representative Knuth.
Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Thiessen, we are wanting to regulate consumer products, and I think pharmaceuticals fall under a different category, and there was a question about mercury and vaccines in the last committee, and I think we will be looking at that and tightening that up to make sure. I don't really want to be having that debate in this bill. I think that's a debate that has started and will continue, and so I think we will be addressing that issue.
And Mr. Chair, and I understand the reason not to have that debate, and maybe it's how you define children's product, but I think it does, when Representative Broad raised that issue, it does kind of raise this question of banning a particular type, a particular chemical without kind of the context of what it's used for and, what other public policy considerations are kind of involved in whether it should be there or not. So it just kind of struck me as an interesting thought experiment, if nothing else.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, I think if you look when we favor alternative priority chemicals and sales prohibition, Section 5 on page 5, there's also, and then if you look again on page 7, there's waivers for specific uses. If there are cases where there's a specific use for it that it's not technically or economically feasible to have the alternative, and that we have a significant public health or environmental reason to have a product, there is a process to deal with that. And so if you can see on section line 7.13, if there are no technically or economically feasible alternatives for the use of priority chemical and sales products, they can be granted a waiver.
And okay,
Representative Thiessen.
Mr. Chair, I have seen that. I'm not... It strikes me that there probably are technical or economically feasible alternatives to vaccines that have mercury in them. I don't know what that... I kind of raise the question of what does that mean? What is technically and economically feasible or not? And I don't know if there's any thoughts on what... If you have any thoughts on what... If there's any kind of more specific definition to be put around that. Or is it just up to the judgment of the commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, right now it's up to the judgment of the commissioner and the agency, and I think if you want to work with me on that and we can figure out some options, I think it was important to have that in there to make sure that we're not irresponsibly getting rid of some uses if there's no other alternative, and that's not what we're trying to do, but I think there in many cases are safer alternatives, and looking at some of the toxic chemical regulation we've seen in Europe and in other states, they are moving this direction and they are finding safer alternatives, and I think Minnesotans and our kids deserve those safer alternatives, and we should expect that of our state agencies.
Okay. Thank you.
Can I just do one other thing for this witness? I think I don't know who. Have you heard? You're still going to hear from the other witnesses?
Yes.
Yesterday. Okay. Can you talk just a little bit about what other states are doing with regard? I mean, this is based, as I understand, on kind of a Maine model.
Mr. Chair, Representative, to be perfectly honest, I'm the policy person at ACC, and so I have provided some input from a regulatory standpoint on that. So I'm not the expert on the states. I do know that Maine has had a similar bill. I honestly don't even know whether it's passed yet or not. So unfortunately, I don't think I'm the right person to get you that information. If you're interested, we can certainly get it to you.
I'm sure we'll have it
somewhere else. Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, we have Kevin Chula from Healthy Legacy can comment on some. She's had conversations with folks in both Maine and Washington, which is, has been kind of leading the way on comprehensive chemical policy, and we can get some more information from her.
That would be good. And Mr. Roberts, I was wondering if there is, it sounds to me like your main opposition isn't so much to the bill itself and what it's trying to accomplish. It's just tightening up some of the language, some concerns that you have about maybe being applied in a way that's not as effective as it could be or should be at trying to root out some of these dangerous toxins, you know, focusing more on exposure, not just hazard, as you said. Is there legislation similar to this that that you or your organization would support if it was tightened up? I was just wondering, you know, if some of the changes that you would suggest were put in, if your organization would be in support of such legislation at the state level being implemented.
Mr. Chair, just so I'm clear, are you asking, is there a similar bill that has all those caveats in it that we are supporting, or are you asking me, would we support it if it had the caveats in it?
If it did have the caveats in it. And yes, if and you were just saying you're not real familiar with the Maine legislation or the Washington legislation, but right. I don't know what your organization's position was on that, if they've been in opposition to Washington and Maine. And if they did put these caveats in, they would be in support.
Mr. Chair, I can say that we were in opposition to the one in Maine. The bill in Washington, I honestly don't know. I'm not aware of a bill that includes the caveats that we're working, that we put forward here. But certainly, ACC has principles that we've developed for chemical regulatory systems that we think should be applied, whether it's been on a federal level or a state level, or quite frankly, even within the chemical companies as they do their own risk evaluation work. And the importance of looking at not just hazard, but on the exposure potential of the chemical as it's in the product that you're developing and you're marketing. If there was a legislation that included those caveats, yes, I think we would be supportive of it. I would caution that it's very different than in the way things have been, and it's the myriad of products that are out there and the different ways that they can be used is, as I've stated, it's a Herculean task, and that's why we would recommend that it be prioritized, certainly within the federal within the federal system. That's what we're suggesting as well. Let's look at the chemicals that we have concerns with, look at the products that those are being used in, look at the exposures related to those, and see if those are in fact safe uses of those chemicals.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Roberts. And Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Roberts, when a little while ago you were talking about, I wrote part of your statement here, why require measurements of toxics, and you were referring to some language in the bill, and I didn't pick up on the specific part of the bill you were referring to. But I took away from that you're implying to me that industry knows all of the byproducts that leach from plastics and other products that are out on the market. Is that a good implication of inference on my part, why measure what's there? Does industry know about these toxic substances that are leaching, and we're just now finding out? I'm exploring this here.
Okay, Mr. Chair, no Representative. Let me go back to the basis for the comment. And the way that we read the bill, it says that if there is a presence of a priority chemical in a child product, and then we start the process of looking at a safer alternative. If there's a presence of that chemical in the product, then the retailers have to tell CCA how much of it is in that product. But there's nowhere in the bill that says, well, if you're over this concentration, you'll be impacted by the safer alternative. From what we can tell, there is no threshold. If the priority chemical is in there, you will be subject to the safer alternative assigned by PCA. And so, therefore, why ask people to go through the rigor of measuring what could be in parts per billion or parts per trillion analytical methods, which, you know, can be complicated and costly?
Just one follow-up. Thanks. That led me to where I hope you might go, actually, and that is, does the ACC take a position? And I, you know, we're at parts per quad and on down now. So,
yeah, exactly.
You know, we're way down there. Has the ACC taken a position on the fact that some chemicals we have no known safe exposure level, particularly with fetuses?
Ms. Roberts.
The ACC's position is that we want to gather what information we can in order to protect children. Our companies are pulling together information and all the rest of it. And as you pointed out, science is evolving. And so what is possible to measure and to test for now may not have been the possibility 10 years ago even. And so, yes, we're encouraging our members to use evolving science and the techniques that are available to them for their products.
Just one final,
if I may. Yourself.
And I, just when you say children, you're including fetuses in that statement?
Yes, sir, I am.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Roberts, my question is a little similar, but I was just wondering if you could tell me in general regarding exposure limits, which you mentioned a number of times. You know, when the testing is done and the standard is set for exposure limits, who is the standard? Which population group are we talking about? Adults? Are we talking about children? Are we talking about men, women? When an exposure limit is set, could you tell me generally who that is and who the testing was done on?
Ms. Roberts.
Mr. Chairman, Representative. First of all, they're not necessarily exposure limits set on every chemical that is out there. That is certainly an issue of concern, again, and when we're trying to work with the federal agencies to make sure that we have better safety determinations, particularly on high-priority chemicals. I think if Dr. Myers will tell you that the programs that have typically been used is you go through the toxicology testing, and then you apply safety factors associated with, as you go through the testing, you come up with what's called a no observed effect level. So none of the animals had any adverse effects seen in them. And then at that level, you start applying safety factors based on that concentration. And it's usually either 100 or 1,000 fold, tenfold to represent the difference that rats or mice are not humans, and then tenfold to address the fact that there's a difference between human to human, we're not all the same, and then another tenfold to address sensitive subpopulations, whether that be the elderly or children, recognizing that they also have a different sensitivity.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Roberts, I was wondering if you could take a look at the legislation in lines 1.17, 1.18, 1.19, the definition of chemical. And representing the American Chemistry Council, is the statutory or the bill definition here, is that a scientifically, first off, is it a scientifically accurate definition? And then secondly, is it a regulatory actionable definition? I mean, can it be something, is this something that agencies or the public could regulate on? Because the whole bill rests upon the definition of the word chemical. Are lines 1.17, 1.18, 1.19 accurate?
Ms. Roberts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I think the first part of the definition is probably acceptable. I haven't seen it, or I don't recall seeing it defined that way before. But the second part, the breakdown of the products or the substances, the breakdown products are in and of themselves chemicals, so you're sort of repeating yourself in the definition here. So I would argue that part of it is probably not appropriate. The idea of using a group of structurally related substances and defining it as a chemical, we call that a category of chemicals. That's something that ACC has supported. Again, because it does help prioritize and focus efforts. Structurally related substances do tend to act similarly, as long as, the similarity is the same, as carbon length doesn't get too long and other chemistry things.
Okay. Representative Hansen.
I'm going to follow up. So the definition would not differentiate between a man-made chemical that's made through chemistry of developing new products and, say, elemental arsenic or lead, etc.
Ms. Roberts.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, you are correct. It does not differentiate between naturally occurring chemicals and man-made chemicals. But that can also be difficult to differentiate as you're looking at a product as well.
Any further questions, Representative Teaser?
Thank you, Sir, Mr. Chair. Just on that, to follow up on that point, then, but the definition of chemical here, though, I mean, there is a distinction with the breakdown, because from a regulatory perspective, even if something is not dangerous at its top level, you would still be regulated if it gets dangerous at its degraded level. And so there is an importance of having both of those phrases in. Is that, well, maybe this is a question for Representative Lewis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Thiessen. I don't know all of the examples, but I know in case of flame retardants, PDBs, which you've probably heard about in the last couple of years, they are regulated at the penta and octa level, but not at the deca level, I'm getting this right, but deca can actually degrade into penta and octa, so it can degrade into more toxic types. So it can be difficult if you ban certain ones, but the one that's not banned can degrade into those more toxic ones. So I think that's what it's trying to get at there.
Any other questions? Okay, seeing none, thank you, Ms. Roberts.
Again, thank you to the committee for adjusting time.
Appreciate your time. And next we have Ms. Kathleen Schuler for a Healthy Legacy. Welcome, Ms. Schuler.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Please state your name for the record.
I'm Kathleen Schuler. I work for the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. I also represent Healthy Legacy, a statewide public health coalition representing 30 groups throughout Minnesota. Some of our members are...
Oh, I guess, Ms. Schuler?
Sorry.
Thank you very much.
The Minnesota Council of Churches, the state PTA, the Minnesota Nurses Association, the ARC, Twin Cities, Learning Disability Association, a diverse coalition working for safe products made safely. Why this is a public health and environmental problem is that people are exposed to everyday chemicals and consumer products in their own homes, things that they use in their communities and schools and so forth. And the American Public Health Association has a resolution calling for chemical policy reform and for promotion of green chemistry because of their concern. The Minnesota Public Health Association has adopted a similar resolution, and there's a letter of support from MCHA in your packet. This is also an environmental problem because chemicals that we put in our consumer products don't stay there. They end up in our land and our water and in our bodies. Why we're working on this at the state level is because the federal regulations are failing to protect us. The Toxic Substances Control Act is the federal regulation that regulates industrial chemicals that are used in consumer products. And in the 32 years that TSCA has existed, they've only required safety testing on 200 chemicals and only regulated 5 chemicals. And it's not because the rest of them are safe. It's because TSCA is fatally flawed, as illustrated by Representative Timmons mentioned that the GAO said that TSCA is failing to protect public health. The approach in the Toxic Free Kids Act is basically a common sense approach to evaluating all chemicals instead of going by a chemical by chemical approach. It does not require testing by the Pollution Control Agency. It requires using existing authoritative sources to identify chemicals of high concern as described by Representative Timmons. Their source is already out there. We mentioned a couple of states that have already passed similar bills, Washington and Maine. They're coming up with priority lists of chemicals. And the list of chemicals of high concern is about 1,500 chemicals. The ones that are in children's products are probably between 50 and 80 chemicals. These lists are going to be shared, and the Pollution Control Agency can use existing information and existing data sources. We to address another concern that Ms. Roberts brought up, we define safe alternatives as those that are functionally equivalent in a product or process. So If, for example, if you take the car seat, we're not going to look at the properties of the car seat, how strong the plastic is, whether the car seat actually works as a child. That's another whole issue. But if the car seat contains, for example, dicabromodiphenyl ether, which is a persistent bioaccumulative toxin, then it would not be allowed in the car seat because it could get into the ducts and expose the child. So this is a hazard-based approach because it doesn't have to go through a long risk assessment process. Risk assessment is appropriate in some cases, but we don't have to do an extensive exposure analysis to know that that flame retardant doesn't stay in the car seat and it can expose a child. So in this framework, that particular chemical could ultimately be regulated. We're not actually implementing the regulation until a pollution control agency reports back to the legislature on how it would be funded and how they would do this. Basically, it would be, right now, it would be putting the list together and coming up with a list of priority chemicals. And then it would be assisted by the fact that there's an interstate chemicals clearinghouse to share information among states. The pollution control agency wouldn't have to do an alternative analysis on every chemical because other states are doing that and putting it into this database. Thanks very much.
Okay. Well, thank you, Ms. Schuler. Any questions for Ms. Schuler? Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So how is the list of chemicals we're going to come up with under this legislation different than the list that Maine or Washington would come up with? And if it's going to be the same, well, anyway, that would be, are we expecting we're going to get a different list here?
Well, if they use similar, Mr. Chair, Representative, if they use the same criteria, then it would end up being a similar list. I mean, we can't really dictate that Minnesota use Maine's list, but they may decide to use it as kind of a shortcut instead of going through the whole process again.
Yeah. I think the main point is that there is information that we can already utilize, having our own standards, but we can certainly use the information that's already out there, either through the clearinghouse or through Maine and Washington, which have already gone through a similar process. Representative Hansen.
On that point, Mr. Chair, and for the testifier, I'm looking on page 3 where you define the authoritative sources to evaluate criteria. And you have 1, 2, 3, and 4 lines 3.9 through 3.18. So each of those agencies that would identify the sources, they would use peer-reviewed science publications there. To create the list, they have to be able to defend the list from litigation. There's going to be published and reproducible results. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's the idea. Instead of having each state agency have to generate all this data, they would use existing authoritative sources that use peer-reviewed studies.
And Mr. Just a point of information, the committee, we actually added on about 4 more of those in the last committee, which would show up here in an amendment. So it's actually a broader list.
Yeah, and that would be the A2 amendment, which is in the packet.
Yeah.
So, any other questions for Ms. Schuler? Representative Gardner.
Well, maybe this is for Representative Pinus, too, but maybe I'll ask this to the PCA also. We're being so specific about what sources we want the agency to consult, and I'm suspecting that those agencies have probably identified some high priority chemicals of concern, so why not just legislate those 5 from here? Is there anything that we would hear from those agencies that we couldn't figure out with staff here? I'm just out of curiosity.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, we did actually add with the state of Washington coming out with their list, or Connecticut, and it's the whole idea of shared government services and trying to save money for the state. You know, one option is they could just take the Washington list, but I don't. I have to look at our research staff in terms of totally ceding that authority to another state, and I think we would have some problems with that. But I think using their evaluation and assessment as a way to
not be duplicating significant efforts, I think would be very useful and something I'm open to.
This is my point, I guess, is really if why not the legislature take the list from Washington State rather than have to go through a PTA process to review the literature? If there's five top ones that you feel are not good for kids, we could just pass it. Or do you feel that a chemical by chemical thing by the legislature is not a good thing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, I think we've seen the chemical by chemical approach. I don't think it's a good use of resources. I don't think legislators are necessarily the best scientifically equipped to make those decisions. And we had the fight with Bell Lake last year, and we passed the bill, and it was vetoed and then banned federally. I think we're working on BPA this year, and I think there are some chemicals that rise to that level, and since we don't have this sort of system set up, I think it makes sense with some chemicals where I think in the case of the two cases I mentioned, I do think it rises to that level, but I think it's not the most effective way to do it, and I think a lot of things could be falling through the cracks. And so that's why I'm putting forward this more comprehensive process for dealing with it.
Yeah, and I see this as more of an ongoing process that you're trying to establish here rather than more of a proactive approach. I see the legislature oftentimes acting in a reactive way rather than proactively. So I guess I see that as being one of the main motives of the bill, is to establish a framework for an ongoing process here. Mm-hmm. Any other questions at all? Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Knuth and Ms. Schuler, Section 8 lists some exemptions, if you will. Do agricultural chemicals fall under the definition under 7.22? And then if you flip the page to 8.1, I see item number 7 there under that section. It's kind of puzzling to me why we would exempt packaging for food or beverage products. I'm kind of confused. Can you give us a rationale for those? And then, secondly, back to the first question, are ag chemicals exempted?
Chair, we're looking at toxic chemicals in children's products, and frankly, I don't really want ag chemicals in products meant for kids 12 and under, and we're not trying to get at the general uses of them. And I'm not exactly sure if it would be under there, but in terms of the regulating for in products of children 12 and under, I hope we don't have egg chemicals in those products. And then on the container packaging of food beverage, I would let Kathleen talk about this one a little bit more.
So the intention was to regulate products for children under 12. Not all general food and beverage containers that would be used by adults and everybody else. So that's why the language is specific to food that's packaged for younger children, so baby food and things like that.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Keith?
No, Mr. Chair, we have a testifier here, and I was hoping we could get him to testify before we have further questions, because he might open. He'll probably open up a whole other area of questions.
Sure. So, and that would be Mr. John Peterson Myers, Dr. Peterson Myers.
Mr. Chair.
Myers.
Yeah. Thank you. Chair.
Please say your name for the record.
My name is John Peterson Myers, Pete Myers. I am Chief Scientist of Environmental Health Sciences, a science-based not-for-profit in Charlottesville, Virginia. I'm pleased to be sharing this cold day with you here in Minnesota. Thank you for inviting me. I'd like to begin with an observation that is troubling, but I will follow it up with a point that I think is of great importance and encouragement. And the observation is that this generation of children, we learned from public health officials, is the first in many generations, possibly about back to the Black Death, that is less healthy than their parents. first generation. That's a big public health challenge. There are many factors contributing to it, but there is now serious scientific evidence that the sorts of phenomena that would be regulated by this bill are contributing to those health problems. The good news is that new science is emerging that is telling us that we can actually prevent some of these childhood health problems. And my slides got ahead of me. I apologize for you for that. We could probably prevent some of these health problems by acting in the types of ways that are contemplated by this legislation. I want you to think for a moment about the following metaphor. And think of it in the context of the development of a child from in the womb through infancy all the way to adulthood, and indeed to old age. Because the types of things that are being contemplated in this bill have relevance not just to the health of a child, but to the health of that child as it ages and lives throughout its entire life. But the core aspect of a whole generation of new science has emerged over the past 20 years. That metaphor is imagine that you are the U.S. Coast Guard, and your responsibility is to shepherd ships from one side of the ocean to another, shepherd a child from birth through to old age. The way toxicology used to think about this was their responsibility was to keep the ships from being bombed, being blown up by large quantities of bombs, or by protecting children from large quantities of chemicals. Because we know that high amounts cause serious damage. What this new science is focusing on is the question, is the compass set in the right direction? Or is it 1 or 2 degrees off? An amount of problem that would not be detected at birth, nor as the boat is leaving the port, but is detectable by the time it reaches middle to late age, or by the time the boat, instead of winding up in London, is on a rocky shore in Portugal. This new science looks comprehensively at the entire life of an organism, how its genes are affected, how the behavior of its genes are being changed as it's exposed in the womb, and how that plays out over life. This is a revolutionary new aspect of science. As I said, it's been developing over the last 20 years. Some parts of it are very clear. Some parts of it, frankly, are still in serious scientific development. And I've been asked by my representative to describe where this science is headed, because, in fact, what it does is creates a great deal of hope about our ability to change that observation I mentioned at the outset, that this generation of children is less healthy than their parents, to where the next generation could be healthier than their parents. That's where the science is headed. And so what I'd like to do is to describe to you briefly a revolution that's unfolded over the last 20 years in environmental health science that has revealed new links between human health and contamination, including things that, while exposure takes place in the womb, it's affecting chronic diseases of adulthood. And it involves some of the very products that we've been discussing here today. Things that are in certain types of plastics. Not all plastics, but some types of plastics. Things that old toxicology taught us were safe. But this new toxicology is saying they're definitely problematic. And again, I emphasize what this science does is it opens up new opportunities for prevention through policy initiatives exactly the sort that you're contemplating here. What does this mean, this revolutionary shift? It seems that traditional toxicology and epidemiology that mostly have focused on the consequences of high-dose exposures have missed entirely what chronic low-dose exposures can do to human health, and especially what exposures in the womb can do to the course of development of the fetus and affect its health early in life and, in fact, throughout its life. What we now know from this science is that regulatory toxicology and epidemiology and medicine can do a much better job at incorporating this science. And when they do, when it does, when the current generation of regulations, which unfortunately, as you were discussing earlier, face most things one chemical at a time, when we begin to step back and deal with this more comprehensively, we're going to lead to a healthier generation of people. There are four key discoveries in this science. The first one is that some contaminants can alter gene behavior at extremely low doses, the sorts of doses that Representative Purcell was mentioning earlier. High-dose experiments, the types of procedures we have depended upon for decades to detect what is safe and what is not, these procedures don't anticipate the consequences of low-dose effects. Mixtures are ubiquitous. Lots of chemicals surround us. Lots of chemicals are inside us. The current standards, the current ways to regulate these things have not incorporated known effects of mixtures. There it is, but we don't yet, we haven't brought the current standards in to reflect that development in science. And finally, as I mentioned earlier, adult chronic diseases can be programmed during development. These are the four key elements of this new way to approach this. I use this one slide to make three of these four points. I won't have time to develop the mixture argument today. These are representatives of an experiment done by the National Institute of Health. The animal on the right is the representative of the experimental group. The animal on your left is representative of the control group. It was the same strain of mice, the same caloric intake, the same activity level, and yet one is grotesquely obese. What's happened? Well, that experimental group was exposed to one part per billion at birth to a synthetic estrogen, a hormone-disrupting compound. This is, in this case, it's diethylstilbestrol. We can do this with a number of different hormone-disrupting compounds. And that exposure, according to the current interpretation, that exposure led stem cells to be more likely to be converted to fat cells in that animal, leading it to become obese. So here's an interesting observation. What happens is instead of exposing it to one part per billion, you would expose it to 1,000 parts per billion. That animal would have been skinnier than the control animal. It would have lost weight. At high doses, this compound and other endocrine disrupting compounds can cause weight loss. But at low doses, the ones that stimulate this conversion of stem cells to fat cells cause grotesque obesity. And it's a result of a neonatal exposure just after birth. So here you've got three elements of this revolution. Low levels matter. High-level tests can't be used to predict low-level effects. And early life exposures can ripple through the life of the person or the organism. Where is all this rooted, this new science? It's actually rooted in molecular genetics, in the genetic basis of many human diseases. And most people, when they hear me say that, they scratch their heads because they confuse two key parts of what it means for a disease to have a genetic basis. One is, actually, we do inherit our genes from our parents, and it matters that you get a functional gene in the first place. But actually, genes are being turned on and off in our bodies trillions of times a second throughout our life. They're making crucial products that are essential for our health. And if they're turned on at the wrong time, and they produce a product at the wrong time, it can have disastrous consequences. If they aren't turned on when we need them, it can have disastrous consequences. So the factors that control gene expression, turning on and turning off of genes, are vital to health. And environmental factors, we now know, can play a central role in the control of gene expression. Gene expression, what controls it? Well, it does matter what you inherit. It also turns out that genes, often through hormones, are talking to other genes constantly. But environmental factors, including diet, stress, experience, and environmental contaminants, can also have profound consequences in the control of gene expression. We are growing a list of contaminants that are capable of altering gene expression at low levels of exposure. Bisphenol A, the major building block of polycarbonate plastic, is the poster child of this issue. But there are others that also have emerged as important factors affecting gene expression many times during life. What this does, what this new look at, this reframing does about what it means for a disease to be linked to a gene, is it flips on its head this classic dichotomy of nature versus nurture, gene versus environment, and instead focuses on the fact while we do inherit our genes from our parents, the environmental factors that control the behavior of those genes can be just as vital to health as whether or not you got the right gene in the first place. So what that does is it has forced into toxicology a new perception of what it means for a disease to be linked to a gene. How many of you have read sometime in the last 6 months something in the mainstream media about what the Human Genome Project has discovered? This disease is linked to that gene, schizophrenia is linked to a gene, diabetes is linked to a gene. Most people, when they hear that, they respond fatalistically. Oh my God, did I get the bad gene from my folks? I respond very differently, because what this science is telling us is that some portion of that disease may be driven by environmental factors affecting that gene's expression, and that gives us an opportunity to intervene and prevent that disease in the first place. This isn't about toxic terror. This is about opportunities to prevent significant diseases that are currently affecting our children and ourselves. So, we used to think, on the basis of old models of toxicology, only high levels matter. We now know that, certainly with some of the compounds I listed earlier, that impacts can occur at everyday levels, levels that are present within many of the people in this room, levels that could not be measured 20 years ago. I'm going to share with you one picture of the inside of a mouse. I apologize. People in Minnesota are not seeing the part. So this is an adult mouse. It's about my age in mouse years. It's a healthy mouse. It's grown up. Its bladder is functional. Its kidneys are working. What would happen to that mouse if its mother, while it was pregnant, had been exposed to about 20 parts per billion of bisphenol A? It would grow up looking like that. And you can see there's something wrong with the bladder. In fact, if that animal had been allowed to age 2 days longer, its bladder would likely have exploded. The kidneys are already necrotic. They don't work. And I want you to think back to that Coast Guard metaphor that I mentioned before. This is at the other side of the ocean. This is following exposure in the womb. The animal was slightly off course in the following way. There were certain what are called epigenetic factors that were altered in a key place in the urethra of the mouse. The urethra is the tube that connects the bladder to the outside world. Okay? And what happened was that the expression of certain genes in that key place, the position in the urethra, was changed so that the course of development as the animal aged was altered, and ultimately the urethra grew in a way that it became completely constricted and the animal could no longer pee. And that's the result. Following very tiny exposures in the womb. This is one representative of many findings of this sort that now we know can affect brain development, can affect the development of the urinary tract, can affect development of the reproductive tract, alter immune system function, can have consequences that ripple throughout the health of the organism. One of the most recent, troubling but also hopeful results just published in the Journal of the American Medical Association this past September shows that, again, bisphenol A, the poster child of these issues, at levels in Americans today, slightly higher than average, dramatically increases the risk of cardiovascular disease, coronary heart disease, heart attack, and type 2 diabetes. These are not minor health problems in America today. Type 2 diabetes costs this country $217 billion a year. And this finding is telling us that some portion of that burden may be avoidable by implementing public policies that reduce exposures. How did we wind up in a condition like this where regulatory toxicology has so grotesquely missed problems of this nature? Well, it has to do with key assumptions that followed by regulatory toxicology. It assumes there is a safe dose beneath which exposures, there's a threshold level beneath which exposures are safe. It also has to do with an assumption of the shape of the dose response curve. That in essence, you go from low dose to high dose, you go from low effect to high effect. And we're learning that for certain types of contaminants, those contaminants that interfere with hormone expression, the endocrine disrupting compounds, they actually behave like hormones. And we know that hormones, medical endocrinologists will tell you that hormones at one concentration will stimulate one set of genes to express,
and another set of, and another lower concentration or higher will affect a completely different set of genes. So you can't, from the what you're finding at one concentration, you cannot predict what will happen at another concentration. You have to test at a wide range of concentrations, which is something that current toxicology does not do at the threshold. These assumptions, core to regulatory toxicology as it has been practiced, are not challenged. The predicted safe doses that are established, following some procedures I'll lay out in a moment, they're never tested. They're assumed to be correct. I'll skip this slide. Let me simply say that these odd-shaped dose response curves are found with increasing frequency as endocrinologists enter in the field of toxicology and bring endocrinological sensibilities into the study of how contaminants can affect health. I want to take you to one very specific example because I think it's something that people will recognize. How many of you know what tamoxifen is? Tamoxifen is one of the key pharmacological agents used to treat breast cancer. It's at high levels, it's an anti-androgen. It is an endocrine disruptor at high levels. And you can see at the on the far right side of the curve, you can see that's what doctors are trying to get in the serum of women with breast cancer because they're trying to suppress the growth of the tumor. Okay, that's why the graph is going down there. At high levels, you suppress the growth of the tumor. But you can see in this graph, at levels 1,000 or so fold beneath where the tumor growth is suppressed, you see actually what physicians refer to as the tamoxifen flare, where actually tamoxifen stimulates growth of the tumor. The exact opposite as the effect of a high level. This is a classic result in looking at how different things happen at different parts of the dose response curve that can't be predicted by simply focusing on high doses. Let's imagine for the moment that, oh, I should say that physicians actually structure their dosing of tamoxifen to avoid that flare. They want to make sure that when women get on tamoxifen, they don't skip treatment because that then their serum titer starts to drift back towards that and they move into a zone where they're at risk of stimulating tumor growth. So let's imagine that we use classic regulatory toxicology procedures to determine what level of tamoxifen is safe for you. So what you do is you establish a no effect, a no observed adverse effect level, the NOEL, where there's no difference between the control exposure and the experimental controls. And I've drawn an arrow showing you where that point is on the graph. You then use the safety factors that we heard about earlier, where a factor of 10 is introduced. So because kids aren't little adults, a factor of 10 is used additionally because people aren't little animals, or animals aren't little people, and then you use an additional factor to take into account individual variation among people. Using those standard procedures, you would divide the NOEL by 1,000, and you would actually come up identifying as safe the very zone of concentration which is the most dangerous. This is the process by which all regulatory toxicology has proceeded in establishing the standards that we currently depend upon today. This is why, to a significant degree, we have missed effects of the sorts that I've talked about. So we've got some bad news here. There has been widespread exposure to compounds that interfere with gene expression, sometimes at extremely low levels. The sort of procedures we've used, 20th century epidemiology and toxicology, simply cannot be trusted to find real effects with these complications. The good news, though, is what I really want you to focus on, because it's where this new policy proposal is taking you. A disease under genetic control may be one caused by genetic hijacking. Some portion of that disease burden may be preventable as we implement the public policies that take the current approaches to regulation out of the scientific traffic and bring them up to represent modern science. That's actually really good news. We can improve these regulations. Science is always going to advance farther. We know enough now to start acting. We can design better products. There's a field called green chemistry, which is emerging, which is using design signals out of the science I work on to ask, is there a way that we can make a molecule that can't combine with the estrogen receptor but can be polymerized into making a plastic that can hold water? It's a really exciting field that's going to lead to a lot of economic innovation as it unfolds. Our challenge, there are many scientific questions that still need to be answered. Science never ends. But I think we know enough now to start incorporating this advance in science into a new generation of precautionary health standards. And I think the proposal before you represents a reasonable first step in that direction. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. New questions, Paul. Representative Turner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just was wondering why the study is unpublished in that, then. Is there a credibility or challenge on that? Is it just too new out there? Or
That study was presented last summer at a scientific meeting, and it's currently in preparation for scientific publication.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Myers, if someone approached you and asked you to respond to the hypothesis of hormesis, what would your response be in that dose response kind of a framework?
Well, there are some superficial similarities. Hormesis is a theory that low doses stimulate and high doses suppress, and that low dose stimulation is good for health, whereas high doses is bad. The problem with hormesis is that it approaches low dose stimulation as basically always good, and it's clear that sometimes there may be at least a current beneficial effect of a low-dose stimulation. For example, if you've got an immune system that's not functioning well and you can pump it up a little bit. But the problem with hormesis is it usually only looks at one endpoint at once. And the factors that bisphenol A, for example, alters the expression of at least 200 genes. If you only look at one of those endpoints, you might think that, oh, that's good. But when you begin to look at the cumulative impact, they're almost never, if ever, cumulatively beneficial.
Thank you. Thanks. Dr. Representative Pearson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It strikes me that the kind of whole distinct, one of the kind of critical issues here is whether dose is even a relevant concept anymore, because this legislation basically takes the approach that dose doesn't matter and that we should just ban these chemicals if there is a safe alternative, if they exist anywhere in the environment. And I just, is that consistent? I just kind of get your scientific reaction.
From a scientific perspective, dose is relevant. It isn't that, in the examples that I gave, it isn't that low doses are always bad or always worse or always better than high dose. It is that at one dose, you have one set of effects that with endocrine disrupting compounds and hormones can't be predicted from high doses. It vastly complicates the process of risk assessment because you have to look at a full spectrum of exposures, and that's very expensive, and it is virtually never done except in academic laboratories. So you enter into this zone where you don't have the low dose exposures, results of low dose exposures, but you're depending upon high dose experiments to say this is going to be safe or not. And the reason why I think at least some people are saying, well, let's abandon the notion that we can get a fully comprehensive scientific view of the effects of doses across the full range, is the expense of doing that completely.
Okay. And one other question.
Representative Easton.
Thank you. That's helpful, too. Where is science or kind of in turn? Is it just an expense issue with regard to moving towards this new kind of analysis? I mean, where is science in kind of looking at, instead of following the kind of traditional path of figuring out the point where there's no observable effect and then kind of bringing it down, where are scientists with regard to kind of shifting to this new thing? Because ultimately that's where we want to get to. I would assume you would say, if in a world without expense, as opposed to kind of a larger kind of sledgehammer approach. I don't want to characterize it that way, I'm sorry, but in perspective. And I'd just like to get, are we close to that, or is that a long way away?
Doctor.
Representative. We're moving in that direction. There are a number of factors I wasn't able to address because of time. The mixture issue in particular is one of those complications. Timing of exposure, what happens at day 17 can be very different when it happens at day 23. And we've depended upon a system that regulates chemicals by chemical for decades now, and it hasn't worked. We're still forcing moms to be chemical engineers to go shopping for their kids. We don't have the data in hand, and we have to step back and develop a system that is able to do much better than one chemical at a time, because we're losing, we aren't gaining ground, we're losing ground. There are more chemicals coming in the market today, they're coming in the market today at a faster rate than we can do an adequate job testing them. We're losing ground. So we have to be creative at developing new ways to deal with this conundrum.
Thank you,
Dr. Myers. And one thing you'd mentioned was the green chemistry, and I see a potential for linking, you know, what's being attempted here, and promotion of some kind of green chemistry to replace some of these priority chemicals that are found to be highly toxic to children. One of the things I see in this bill is that if there's already an alternative available, then it could be banned. Is there anything being done in Washington or Maine that would encourage the development of some kind of green chemistry alternative for high priority toxins, instead of just saying if there's an alternative already available, but actually seeking out an alternative?
Chair, there are things underway in a number of states to encourage investment in the innovation that green chemistry represents, and viewing it as an economic opportunity for those states to take the lead. There's work in Maine specifically on that. The governor signed a bill, I think, 2 years ago that actually looks at the use of green chemistry findings to make new use of Maine potatoes, to make plastic out of Maine potatoes. And they passed a bond that I think it's $50 million, and part of that goes toward innovation using green chemistry, specifically on this alternative plastic made from potatoes. You've hit, though, upon a very important issue. Green chemistry is in its infancy, and it's in some cases it has produced alternatives, but in many cases it hasn't. And I think that ultimately what this country needs, and perhaps Minnesota has an opportunity to take a lead here, are some parallel investments in the sorts of research that is necessary to make that that solution move forward faster.
Yeah. And legislation of this nature would point out those areas where we could probably be investing some of those resources in developing such alternatives. So, more question.
There's a bill in, too, that would kind of move us much more specifically on the product development, green chemistry, economic development side as well, that people may want to check out.
Okay, good. Is the author Representative Thiessen?
No.
Any other questions? Representative Purcell. Oh, excuse me, Sterner.
Okay, thank you. I just was wondering, you mentioned the chemicals are kind of being created faster, we can test them. Would it be a good thing to go to like an FDA-type standard and its best day of FDA where they'd be tested before they'd come to market? Is that something could be reasonably happen so we slow down these untested chemicals to market?
Chair, Representative.
Dr. Meyer.
That would be a good step. Right now, unfortunately, I think the general perception is that the FDA is broke. And witness the potato, or excuse me, the peanut butter scandal that's unfolding right now, where they actually had to get permission of the company to recall the peanuts. That's in today's New York Times. The FDA is not working right now, and it's not testing adequately. On the other hand, you face the question, who should be paying for that research? And really, in some way, the mechanism has to be developed wherein the people who are going to benefit economically from the new product need to be involved in supporting the research to test its safety. There's some very deep issues that are involved in figuring out how to work that out, and no one's gotten it right yet. But there is room for more federal or state involvement in that testing, but also it needs to be done in a way that the costs are borne by the beneficiary.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, Representative.
I have a question for Representative Canoes. Can I just do that quick?
Sure.
One question in the process here. How do you go from the priority, the chemical of high concern list to 5. What's the criteria that the PCA would use?
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen and Kevin Schuler can help answer this as well, but when we're looking at the chemicals of high concern, it's looking at a much wider group of chemicals, and then we're trying to narrow that down by how much humans come into contact with them, I guess, is basically kind of the simple way to put it, and there's a bunch of criteria. And we're trying to make the workload manageable, and I also want to make sure that there are that something is coming out of the agency, so having a certain number by certain dates is part of the reason I'm doing that. We're, you know, in the Environment Committee, we're really working on budgeting for outcomes, and I think coming out with a certain number of priority chemicals is outcomes. And I think 5 is pretty reasonable compared to the thousands of chemicals that are on our market, many of which haven't been tested or shown to be safe.
And Mr. Chair, I guess I don't disagree with anything you just said. I'm just wondering what the... Is it just going to be up to the agency to figure out what those 5 are using the criteria they come up with?
Mr. Chair.
Yep.
Okay.
Thank you. Any other questions at all? And seeing none, we do have 2 other testifiers, and we could go over a little bit, but Environment Finance, I understand, is going to be using this room after us at about 6:30. I understand that to be correct. So... and we have 2 testifiers to go, and we'll start with Julia Earl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome, Ms. Earl, and if you could state your name for the record.
My name's Julia Earl, and I'm here testifying today as the parent of 2 young children, Ben and Sophie, who are currently 9 and 6 years old. I'm here today speaking in support of House File 250. When I was pregnant with my children, I did everything I could to ensure healthy outcomes for them. I stopped drinking coffee and alcohol, I took prenatal vitamins, and I stayed away from toxic fumes, insisting that my husband and father-in-law stain and varnish a dresser that my husband and I had painstakingly assembled for a newborn baby. In spite of taking all these action steps during pregnancy, I was completely baffled when it came to identifying and purchasing products for my children once they were born. I'm well educated. I have a Master's of Science degree, and my husband is a college professor. Still, between the 2 of us, we didn't know if baby and kids products were safe for our children. This included everything from bottles to shampoo and even toys. Finding safe products for babies and children shouldn't be added to the already daunting and exhausting work of parenting and keeping our children safe. As parents, we do everything we can to keep them safe. The myriad tasks include covering electrical outlets, preventing pot handles from sticking out over the edge of the stove, turning down our hot water heaters to prevent scalding, using car seats, and of course holding our toddler's hands as we cross the street. Because the federal government currently lacks a system for requiring human health safety testing, please help keep my children and all Minnesota children safe from exposure to harmful chemicals by supporting House File 250, the Toxic Free Kids Act. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Earl. Any questions for Ms. Earl? Okay, seeing none, thank you for your testimony today.
Very welcome. Thank you.
And the last one we have, Mr. Sandusky from CCA. Welcome, Mr. Sandusky.
Chair, members, thank you. I am Mike Sandusky. I'm the Director of the Environmental Analysis and Outcomes Division of the Pollution Control Agency. I'll keep my comments brief. First of all, it's probably important to establish, but I don't think there's any debate in this room right now, there is an ineffective, if not failed, federal framework for a lot of risk regulatory issues, including toxins and products. And in fact, if I had more time, I'd allude to a collaboration that's been going on for some time between my colleagues at the Department of Health, the Department of Ag, the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, the Humphrey Institute, and others who are working on this very issue. So there's no debate about that. They have, there's been a failure. So the issue before you is a very important one. A couple probably agency parochial comments about this. The disciplines and expertise that were referenced by Dr. Myers and others, epidemiology, toxicology, physiokinetics, the science of cancer, exposure pathway, these are all areas of expertise that reside principally and overwhelmingly at the Department of Health, not the Pollution Control Agency. A tangent thought to that is that this bill, good or bad, is a significant departure as it relates to authorities, at least on behalf of the agencies I just referenced. So I think there needs to be some discussion or investigation about proper authorities to actually implement this legislation. Finally, this is an irritation, I'm sorry, but just brought to me recently was the need to invoke a reference to the Consumer Product Safety Commission and their updated federal regulation from last year. I'm only doing that, not to pose it as some panacea for what we need to do, because it certainly isn't, it really only addresses lead for children's products right now. But contained therein is a preemption clause. I'm not a lawyer. I can't get an answer from lawyers about this, but a preemption clause within the federal legislation that seems to preempt state legislation similar to this one if enacted after a date in 2003. So that might be a House Counsel question that needs to be asked on this legislation or similar legislation. I'll be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Director Sandusky. Representative Lagunia.
So I'm surprised to hear you say that you may not have the authority, because I remember years ago when your agency did all the work on toxics in packaging. If you will remember that there were four toxins identified, lead, mercury, cadmium, hexavalent, chromium, and your agency took the lead in helping work those toxins out of packaging. I don't see any difference here. So what's troubling me here is what you're saying is one thing, and what I am hearing is that maybe the agency doesn't want this as an outcome.
First of all, if you see a difference between...
Could you? I'm not quite understanding the question.
Representative Lagunia?
Let me try again. You are the Outcomes Division. Let me try this a wholly different way. You're the Outcomes Division of PCA. I just finished reading your budget, and there are no outcomes in the Outcomes Division. And so what I think that this bill is pressing for is outcomes. Are you resisting that?
Mr. Sandusky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Virginia, let me be clear. The bill speaks to an area where there is obviously a need. That's what I spent some time right at the start of this thing. There does need to be something done. My principal points were the expertise for the fundamental implementation of this bill does not exist at my agency. That's the primary point I'm trying to make. Does there need to be something done about this issue in terms of outcomes? Absolutely.
And I guess to follow up on Representative Lagunia was asking about the four toxins in the packaging that were addressed by your agency and how that would differ from the toxins we're dealing with here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Lagunia. The view is that this is comprehensive and arguably regulates commerce in a way that approach did not at all. And hence the hesitation about the authority question.
Okay.
I don't see it.
And Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, if I could ask Representative Knuth, the author, I have a question. There is no fiscal note. I realize this isn't a fiscal committee, but will there be a fiscal note on this? And then, if there is, what's the intended funding source?
Mr. Chair, Representative, there will be a fiscal note, and we've been amending it, trying to get some of those costs down and trying to get a better handle on that. We have met with the PCA and the Department of Health as we're kind of working through this and had some conversations with my finance chair and figuring out different ways to make it happen. I mean, I strongly believe this is something we should be doing in our state government. If we aren't doing it, why aren't we? And so we'll be working through that in the normal budgeting process. And I've started those conversations, and I'm not going to try to slip this through without a fiscal note. To be clear on that, I think it's very clear that there will be one, and we'll figure out through our budgeting process how to make it work. I'm hoping. That's my hope.
And just a follow-up to that, so you intend to find a revenue stream for the fiscal note?
In terms of looking at, are you talking, Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, in terms of finding a fee, or if our general fund, I think looking at how much it will cost in the agency, and then through our budgeting process, we'll look at that. And I'm not sure if that'll be a fee, or if we'll find general fund, or how we'll do that, but I'll continue working on that. I started those conversations already.
Thank you.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you. Mr. Kadusky, I've got a number of questions that I wanted to follow up based on my conversation. I wasn't sure if the author was going to have a fiscal note or not. And I'm just curious, you questioned whether you were the agency, and if you're not the right agency, I hope we have the Department of Health come to answer the questions then. But this is classifying 80,000 chemicals, identifying priority chemicals, and it talks about manufacturers in other states. And then I'm also concerned about this effort to find the safe alternatives that won't be high concern. I guess first, if I could ask you, and Representative Knuth, we need to do something. I'm not saying we don't, but I'm just curious, Mr. Kadusky, in light of this, what are we talking about as far as people power to do some of these things? This just looks to me to be an astronomical task without any identification here of the number of people involved or what it may amount to.
Representative, obviously we'll respond to a physical note, and we haven't put our heads to that exercise. Maybe now is the time to invoke the notion that one of the costs that we see in implementing this bill, and hence to my earlier point about expertise, will actually be defense of the agency's regulatory actions as we implement this bill. And that's hard to quantify, but based upon my experience, there will be a significant amount of effort to defend the listing that we create and the follow-up regulatory action.
Representative McNamara.
And we have a number of Corduskys in Hastings, and they're not the same as you, Sandusky. I apologize, Mr. Sandusky.
I've been called worse.
Well, so have I. You went to one of my future questions. I had other ones before, but I'm very concerned, and you alluded to it, where it talks about the department. When you find a safer alternative, the department will be determined to use the safer alternative. And then I'm trying to envision what this does for an individual that used a baby bottle or a car seat that you said was a better one, and that baby bottle or car seat, maybe the baby bottle exploded, that thank goodness the shower door I moved a couple of days ago just disintegrated in my hand into pieces of safety glass. But the state, where would the family be as far as liability? I'm just wondering. It maybe is a question for Representative Knuth. If you want to answer because the state historically just throws up their hands and says, state, we have no liability.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, I think that comes under the functionally equivalent, and if you look at the safer alternative, if there's another alternative sold in the United States, if this has already been banned in another state, we'd consider there's a safer alternative to that chemical. If there's an alternative that's not a chemical of high concern, I think we're looking at functional equivalency and also other cases where it's a product that are doing the same thing are being used within within our country or within is being sold within the United States.
One more.
And they'd have they'd have to meet the safety requirements that we already have with the product. And you know, if you're talking about a car seat working at a certain level, or and my assumption is, I would hope that our car seats go through certain product testing and safety testing, and those products with the safer alternative, I would assume, would go through those same things. I think we're not just putting products out there with other chemicals in them that don't go through the other processes that those consumer products go to. I think that's an important part of thinking about this.
And follow up, Representative.
Just real quick, the last part. So, Mr. Sandusky, so you have not had a chance yet to look at all the different implications in the bill and where the department... I mean, I realize you may personally feel that the Department of Health might be better in some instances, but this bill identifies a number of functions that your department's supposed to do. And if you're going to do these without any new revenue, what other things that you're currently doing are not going to get done? What landfills that are getting checked out, or PCBs that we're dealing with, that you and the Department of Health are working on, the East Metro, aren't going to get dealt with? This is huge, and I think we need to know, Representative Knute, exactly what we're dealing with here. I mean, this is interesting stuff, but this is just really, really, really huge.
Mr.
Chair, and we can have Mr. Sandusky answer too here, but I just want I see Representative McGinnis putting her hand out, and I think we'll be going through the PCA budget, and as a member of the Environment Finance Committee, we've been going through the DNR budget with a fine comb, trying to figure out what they're using state tax dollars on. And frankly, I think residents of this state and of this country think our government is doing something about these sorts of things, and if they're not, why aren't we? And maybe this, if we look at our priorities within our PCA budget and we find out, ask some questions about what's happening now and put in some priority outcomes of identifying these high priority priorities, that's something I'm willing to work on this year.
And Mr. Sandusky, did you want to respond or no?
Politely, respectfully, Mr. Chair, no.
Okay. And Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sandusky, I heard this bill in the previous committee, but I stuck around again just so I could have you. what I heard Representative Wiggins say is that you have successfully regulated products before, as with listed metals, and I know you do it with solid waste with some success. And so you're saying that the skill set required to review literature, essentially, from other states or other agencies requires a different skill set? I mean, I think you should be kind of flattered that you're being asked to work on this instead of the Department of Health. It's a good interagency rivalry thing.
Mr. Sandusky.
Mr. Chair, Representative. I guess I should be flattered, but it doesn't feel like that at the moment. No, actually, this is a very serious matter. This is high-wire risk analysis. All of the disciplines I referenced before would be part and parcel of making decisions from literature, yes, and directed to literature, about creating the chemicals that are required, the list that are required to be manufactured out of this bill. The defense, in addition, of making those decisions will require expertise that I am telling you does not exist in my agency, because it's part and parcel of the discipline that one needs to have expertise in to actually mine the literature and understand it in a way that allows one to create those lists and defend them.
And maybe we should have somebody here from the Department of Health.
Just a quick follow-up to Representative Gardner. The governor is going to cut the closed landfill program anyway, whether we put any money into this program or not. So.
And I don't know if anybody here from the Department of Health, whether they have the expertise that you're speaking of. In their department, you said that they do have more expertise in this area. But I assume you can't speak for their department. But, Representative Arginius.
So I think maybe I can come up with a solution here that Representative McNamara and I can agree with, and Mr. Sandusky would like. And that is, right now we are assuming as taxpayers the burden of showing that these chemicals are not going to harm children. Maybe what we should do is tell industry that they can't sell them in this state unless they have shown to us that, with clear and convincing evidence, that these will not harm children. Clear and convincing evidence of a good civil level of evidence. And maybe you and I could join together and say, that's the way we go here, so that the taxpayers will be very happy, and that the burden is on the people who are earning money from the chemicals. What do you think?
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Wagenius. Unfortunately, Representative Wagenius, Minnesota is not an island, and we're adjoined other states, and this is really, really important stuff. I don't question that. But the reality today, you know, we're an economy that is hurting in such an unbelievable way, and I don't want to say that we shouldn't be dealing with issues like this. We should, Representative Canoe, and we should tear the MPCA's budget apart and see if there's room for stuff like this. And I know with Chair Wagenius we will. But the reality, folks, we're dealing with an economy that's worldwide today. And we have to be so careful that we don't have our head in the sand about what we're doing and not realize that we have to keep this economy moving. And, but again, I agree that the safety has got to be our primary concern, but we just can't have our head in our sand.
Mr. Chair, McNamara, if I could comment on that. Two comments. First, I have been looking at the budget a lot, studying the budget trends, commission report, trying to figure out how we get a handle on this. Our biggest increasing expense is healthcare. And if the numbers are right that Dr. Myers is talking about $217 billion on type 2 diabetes, looking at cancers, looking at heart disease, chronic conditions, we could be getting a handle on a budget driver that we'll be dealing with for decades to come. And we have a generation of people my age, frankly, who've been exposed to a lot of these things, and every kid born has been exposed to these things. So I think we're looking at a major budget driver. That can be difficult to quantify, but I think it's also a reason for this bill. And then also, I want to point out the report section of this in terms of how the department will implement the more regulatory aspects of this, and also a plan to pay for that. If you look at when the deadlines are, it's actually in another budgeting cycle, and we want to get them working on how they're going to do this. And you know, I think that we all have agreed we need to do something, and so if you look at that report, it is part of the bill and figuring out how to pay for it.
I was just going to mention also Representative McNamara, I agree, you know, we need to be certainly conscious of the economic situations we're facing now, but we do need to do both, you know, try to promote economic growth and a strong economy at the same time as we're protecting our children. And I think Representative Knuth made a good point about how the two are really interconnected, and you can't really separate the two. And one thing where the two come together as well, I think promoting the green chemistry that was spoken of, if we can create jobs and set Minnesota up to be a leader in that area, that would certainly enhance our economy as well as go a long way towards protecting our citizens, and especially our most vulnerable citizens, our children, from these toxins. So, and then one last thing I wanted to mention as far as you know, the expertise in the PCA. I know there's a lot of work between the departments as well and agencies. Certainly, I would hope that the PCA and the Health Department would work together on efforts of this nature. And again, Representative Gardner brought up again, too, the fact that there's a lot of information already out there that can be accessed and utilized. And are there any other questions or comments?
Well, Mr. Chair, the amendment we added in Representative Peason's committee does explicitly say to consult with the Department of Health or after a consultation with the Department of Health.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Sandusky, Representative Knuth.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Meeting is adjourned.